Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. Today, I'm going to embark on a study of Lamentations, five chapters in the book. We're going to do chapter one today. I will call this chapter Jerusalem as a Menstruating Woman. Now, let me give you some introduction, not only to this chapter, but to the whole book. Jeremiah wrote the book. No name is attached to the book, but internal evidence points to Jeremiah, as Barnes points out. The Jews would read this book in their synagogues on the ninth of the month Ab, or Av. That's Tisha B'Av, very famous day of mourning in the rabbinical calendar. Actually, Jeremiah says the city was burnt on the tenth day of Av, not the ninth day, but the rabbi somehow came up with the ninth. And it would make sense to read the book of Lamentations because that's what's happening. Jerusalem is lamenting for what happened to her, and all the people of Jerusalem are lamenting for the destruction that the Babylonians wreaked upon the city in 586 B.C. The Septuagint calls the book Lamentations, and that's where we get our English name. The first chapter of the book is an acrostic. The first letter of each verse is a letter of the Hebrew alphabet in order of the letters. The first four poems of the book are acrostic. The fifth book is not. Now, Lamentations, even though it was originally part of the book of Jeremiah, it's separated out and put into the writings in the Hebrew Bible canon, not with the prophets. The book contains five lyric poems, five chapters that we're going to go over. So we start now in verses 1 and 2 of Lamentations 1. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. She has become like a widow who is once great among the nations. She who was a princess among the provinces has become a forced laborer. She weeps bitterly in the night, and her tears are on her cheeks. She has none to comfort her among all her lovers. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. So Jerusalem is pictured as a lonely woman sitting on the ground in verse 1. As John Gill puts it, she is like a menstruous woman in her separation. If we drop down to verse 17 of chapter 1 of Lamentations, we read this. Zion stretches out her hands. There is no one to comfort her. The Lord has commanded concerning Jacob that the ones round about him should be his adversaries. Jerusalem has become an unclean thing among them. The unclean thing is said by many commentators to refer to a woman who is unclean because of her menstruation. At least John Gill says that. Now, the woman is sitting. That's the posture of mourners. Here's what Clark and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown both say. The quote is from Clark. The coin struck by Vespasian on the capture of Jerusalem. Now, this is in AD 70 now, not 586 BC. The coin struck by Vespasian on the capture of Jerusalem, on the obverse of which there is a palm tree, the emblem of Judea, and under it a woman, the emblem of Jerusalem, sitting, leaning, as before described, with the legend Judea Capta, Judah captured. And this illustrates this expression, sitting down on the ground in mourning. Here's some other comparable scriptures from Isaiah. Isaiah 47, verse 1, come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no longer be called tender and delicate. And that's not Jerusalem, that's Babylon. Sitting on the ground, and she gets judged by Persia, but the point is when things are not going good, you sit in the dust. Isaiah 3:26, and her gates will lament and mourn, and deserted she will sit on the ground. Now there, Isaiah is referring to Jerusalem being deserted and sitting on the ground. So that's a very poetic figure, a mourning woman, a lonely woman, a separated woman by herself, sitting on the ground, mourning, with her hands in the dirt, probably throwing the dirt on her head. She is like a widow now. God, her husband, has been taken from her, as Adam Clark says, having lost her king. Cities are commonly described as the mothers of their inhabitants, the kings as husbands, and the princes as children. When therefore they are bereaved of these, they are represented as widows and childless. So Jerusalem is a widow because she's lost Yahweh as her husband. Jerusalem is said in verse 1 to have once been great among the nations. As Gill puts this, she ruled over many nations, having subdued them, and to whom they paid tribute, as the Philistines, Moabites, Syrians, and Edomites in the times of David and Solomon. If you will recall, Solomon, who reigned from 970 to 930, was the top dog in the ancient Near East in his time. He was greater than Assyria. He was greater than Egypt. He was greater than the Syrian kingdoms to the north. He was fabulously wealthy and powerful. So she was great at one time, Jerusalem was, but not anymore. She who was a princess among the provinces has become a forced laborer. As John Gill puts it, she is obliged to pay tribute herself, first to Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, then to the king of Babylon in the times of Jehoiakim, and last of all in the times of Zedekiah. Verse 2, Jerusalem weeps bitterly in the night. Her tears are on her cheek. She has none to comfort her among all her lovers. Well, who were her lovers? The Cambridge commentator says the lovers were the neighboring states with whom, in the sunshine of prosperity, she was on friendly terms. We read about Judah's lovers in Jeremiah 4:30. And you, devastated one, what are you doing that you dress yourself in scarlet, that you adorn yourself with gold jewelry, that you enlarge your eyes with paint? You beautify yourself for nothing. Your lovers reject you. They want to take your life. It's interesting that scarlet is still considered the dress of loose women, even in our culture, thousands of years later. Jeremiah 30, verse 14, all your lovers have forgotten you. They no longer look for you, for I have struck you as an enemy would, with the discipline of someone cruel, because of your enormous guilt and your innumerable sins. That's, of course, talking about Babylon coming down and striking Judah. She is a forsaken woman, forsaken by her lovers. Now, here's some examples of the enmity of the nations around Judah. Now, remember, all of these surrounding nations at one time were at peace with Israel, maybe not friends with Israel, but not at war with Israel either. So they were at peace, but now they're turning against her. Now, these examples are from the Cambridge commentary. The Babylonians, the Syrians, the Moabites, the Ammonites were all enemies of Jerusalem when they formerly had been subjugated by Jerusalem, except for the Babylonians. 2 Kings 24, verse 2, the Lord sent Chaldean, that's Babylonian, Aramean, that's Syrian, Moabite, and Ammonite raiders against Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim ruled from 597 to 586. The Lord sent them against Judah to destroy it. According to the word of the Lord, he had spoken through his servants, the prophets. That's interesting. It's not only the Babylonians, but also these other surrounding nations, these lovers of Israel, coming after her. Probably because they were in the Babylonian army, in the Babylonian Empire. Edom is an example of a lover who is turned on Israel. Psalm 137, 7. Remember, Lord, what the Edomites said that day at Jerusalem. Destroy it. Destroy it down to its foundations. That would refer, I'm pretty sure, to the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC. The Edomites were loving that. Yes, sir. Schadenfreude. Let them go down. Lamentations 4:21. So rejoice and be glad, daughter Edom, you resident of the land of Uz. Yet the cup will pass to you as well. You will get drunk and expose yourself. So Edom is rejoicing and glad over the fall of Jerusalem. Edom lives in the land of Uz, south of the Dead Sea, to the east of the Araba Valley and to the west of it. Uz is to the east of it. That was one of the cities of Edom. They're going to get destroyed. They got destroyed by Babylon probably in 582 or so. And then the city of Tyre, on the Mediterranean coast to the north of Israel. We read in Ezekiel 26, 2-3, Son of man, because Tyre said about Jerusalem, good, the gateway to the peoples is shattered. Gateway to the peoples. Jerusalem was a portal. She has been turned over to me. I will be filled now that she lies in ruins. Therefore, this is what the Lord God says. See, I am against you, Tyre. I will raise up many nations against you just as the sea raises its waves. Now, Tyre used to be friendly with Israel. Remember Hiram of Tyre gave the cedars of Lebanon, floated them down the Mediterranean coast so that Solomon could build his fancy temple. How about Egypt? Ezekiel 29 verses 6 through 7. Then all the inhabitants of Egypt will know that I am Yahweh, for they have been a staff made of reed to the house of Israel. When Israel grasped you by the hand, you splintered, tearing all their shoulders. When they leaned on you, you shattered and made all their hips unsteady. Zedekiah was actually in alliance with Pharaoh Hophra of Egypt at the time of the Babylonian siege, which began in 588. They didn't help. They were a reed. They didn't help at all. And then, of course, there's the Assyrians. Now, this would be in an earlier time than Jeremiah, but they were certainly enemies of Israel. Ezekiel 23:5. Ohola, that's a poetic name for Samaria, and Samaria was the capital of Ephraim, which was the major tribe of northern Israel, the northern 10 tribes, Samaria, Ohola, played the harlot while she was mine, and she lusted after her lovers, after the Assyrians, her neighbors. That's referring to the northern kingdom. In the history of the Judges, we see that they tried to make alliances with the Assyrians. I don't remember the particular details right now. Ezekiel 23:9, therefore I gave her into the hand of her lovers, into the hand of the Assyrians, after whom she lusted. That happened in 722 when the Assyrians came and wiped out Samaria, wiped out the northern 10 tribes. Ezekiel 23:12, she lusted after the Assyrians, governors and officials, the ones near, magnificently dressed, horsemen riding on horses, all of them desirable young men. So we see these sexual metaphors being used to describe Israel's adultery, her lusting after lovers instead of her husband, Yahweh. We go down to Lamentations 1, verses 3 through 4. Judah has gone into exile under affliction and under harsh servitude. She dwells among the nations, but she has found no rest. All her pursuers have overtaken her in the midst of distress. The roads of Zion are in mourning because no one comes to the appointed feast. All her gates are desolate. Her priests are groaning. Her virgins are afflicted, and she herself is bitter. So now in verse 3, Judah is said to be under harsh servitude, slavery to the Babylonians. This is appropriate according to John Gill. The people of Jerusalem have been oppressing and afflicting their poor brethren and retaining them in a state of bondage after their 7 years' servitude, contrary to the law of God, for which they were threatened with captivity. You recall the law that says that you could only own a Hebrew slave for 6 years. The seventh year you had to set him free if he wanted to be free. Apparently, the people of Jerusalem were not doing that. We read in Jeremiah 34:13-17 this, thus says the Lord God of Israel, I made a covenant with your forefathers in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, saying, at the end of 7 years, each of you shall set free his Hebrew brother. Notice the contrast between you guys were slaves in Egypt. Now you're going to set free your Hebrew brothers, just like you were set free from Egypt. You're going to set free your Hebrew slaves. At the end of 7 years, you shall set free his Hebrew brother who has been sold to you and has served you 6 years. You shall send him out free from you, but your forefathers did not obey me or incline their ear to me. Although recently you had turned and done what is right in my sight, each man proclaiming release to his neighbor, and you had made a covenant before me in the house which is called by my name, yet you turned and profaned my name, and each man took back his male servant, and each man his female servant, whom you had set free according to their desire. And you brought them into subjection to be your male servants and female servants. So, the people of Jerusalem were violating the law in the matter of slavery. Verse 17, Jeremiah 34, therefore thus says the Lord, you have not obeyed me in proclaiming release each man to his brother and each man to his neighbor. Behold, I am proclaiming a release to you, declares the Lord, to the sword, to the pestilence, and to the famine, and I will make you a terror to all the kingdoms of the earth. Referring, of course, to the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 by the Babylonians. So Jerusalem is under harsh servitude in verse 3. She dwells among the nations, in other words, because she's been taken off into captivity. The nations are represented by Babylon. It's plural because Babylon had a lot of Gentile nations within the empire. But Judah has found no rest. All of her pursuers have overtaken her. Verse 4, the roads of Zion are in mourning. Zion, of course, is a metonymy. The hill in Jerusalem stood for the whole city. And sometimes Zion could stand for the whole nation of Judah, and sometimes for the whole nation of Israel. And in the New Testament, it stood for the new Israel, the church. But here, it's talking about Jerusalem. The roads of Zion are in mourning. As John Gill says, roads may be said to rejoice or look pleasant and cheerful when there are many passengers in them going to and fro. So they may be said to mourn or to look dull and melancholy when no person is met with or seen in them. A lonely road is pretty depressing. Looks sad. Looks like it's in mourning. Why are the roads deserted? Because no one comes to the appointed feast. There were three appointed feasts legally. The law required all males of Israel to come down to Jerusalem for three feasts every year, Passover in spring, Pentecost in the summer, Feast of Tabernacles in the autumn. Nobody's doing it. Why? Because the city's wiped out. There's nobody there to go to the appointed feast. All her gates are desolate. Now that could refer to the gates of the city of Jerusalem. Could refer to the temple gates. Not really clear, but both were desolate. But both were desolate, I'm sure, after the destruction that the Babylonians inflicted upon the city and the temple. Her priests are groaning, the priests of Jerusalem are groaning, and her virgins are afflicted. Her virgins are sad. Now, why are virgins particularly mentioned as afflicted? A couple of options. The first is my option. I didn't get it from anywhere, so take it with a grain of salt. It could be that Jeremiah is referring to the virgins in Jerusalem who had no one to marry and support them because they were all dead or taken off into exile. Or it could be, as Albert Barnes says, that Jeremiah is referring to the virgins who took a prominent part in all the religious festivals of the Jews. Now, women did take part in praising God a lot. I'm going to give you a couple of examples, not referring specifically to a religious festival, but referring to women rejoicing. Jeremiah 31:13. Then, this is referring to the return from Babylon, 538 BC. Then at the return, the young woman will rejoice with dancing, while young and old men rejoice together. I will turn their mourning into joy and give them consolation and bring happiness out of grief. The young woman will rejoice with dancing. Young woman is another way to translate virgin. Exodus 15:20. Then Miriam the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took a tambourine in her hand, and all the women followed her with their tambourines and danced. So, when Jeremiah says in verse 4 of Lamentations 1 that Jerusalem's virgins are afflicted, he could be talking about those virgins who usually danced with joy and praise. They don't do that anymore. Or it could be the virgins who couldn't find anybody to marry. And she herself is bitter. Jerusalem is bitter, of course. We go now to Lamentations 1, verses 5 through 6. Her, referring to Jerusalem, her adversaries have become her masters, her enemies prosper. For the Lord has caused her grief because of the multitude of her transgressions. Her little ones have gone away as captives before the adversary. All her majesty has departed from the daughter of Zion. Her princes have become like deer that have found no pasture, and they have fled without strength before the pursuer. In verse 5, Jeremiah refers to Jerusalem's adversaries. That would be the Babylonians. They have become the Jews' masters. Her enemies prosper. The Babylonians prosper, all right. They were the big dogs in the ancient Near East. For the Lord has caused her grief because of the multitude of her transgressions. It wasn't just a random catastrophe. It was because of Jerusalem's sins that she refused to repent of. Her little ones have gone away. That's her children, the population of Jerusalem. The metaphor daughter of is often used to refer to a population of a city. For example, the daughter of Babylon, the daughter of Jerusalem. Here it's little ones, children, not really daughters, but it's the same idea. They have gone away as captives before the adversary. Now, this would include captives, I'm sure, that went during the first deportation in 597. Mordecai, the famous Mordecai of the book of Esther, he went in 597, and Ezekiel, the famous Exilic prophet, he went in 597, as well as all the others who left Jerusalem. Verse 6, all her majesty is departed from the daughter of Zion. There's the metaphor right there, daughter of, that's the population of Zion. Zion refers to Jerusalem. All her majesty is departed. Her princes have become like deer that have found no pasture. Now, deer like to have a place to eat in peace and safety. I can tell you that because they often use my backyard for pasture. They come around and they're very skittish, and they're always looking around waiting for somebody to shoot them. And that's because there are deer hunters everywhere, but the deer are beating the deer hunters. So the deer are everywhere, and I don't hunt, so I just look at them, and they look at me, and they feel safe, so they can eat in the pasture. That is until a dog comes up and starts barking at them or something like that. And so the deer have found no pasture. That means the princes of Zion have found no safety. They have fled without strength before the pursuer, like deer flee. Deer are extremely timorous by nature, just like the Israelites have become. Deer never turn and fight the hunter. And that's true if the hunter has a shotgun, but I've seen deer around here chasing my sister's dogs. The most disgraceful thing I've ever seen. I told that dog that he ought to be ashamed of himself. His name was Wayne, to be chased by a deer. That's backwards. At any rate, we go down to Lamentations 1, verses 7 through 8. In the days of her affliction and homelessness, Jerusalem remembers all her precious things that were from the days of old, when her people fell into the hand of the adversary and no one helped her. Again, the adversary is Babylon, 586 B.C. The adversary saw her. They mocked at her ruin. Jerusalem sinned greatly. Therefore, she has become an unclean thing. All who honored her despise her because they have seen her nakedness. Even she herself groans and turns away. Now, in verse 7, Jerusalem is said to remember all the precious things that she had but lost. It's easy to remember in exile the things one took for granted in everyday life. I remember living in China for 23 years on and off, mostly on at the end, and thinking about all the things I was missing in America. I would have killed for a hamburger, just one hamburger. But I'm over here, the hamburgers are everywhere. I don't really long for them anymore. I don't appreciate hamburgers enough. Well, what were some of those things that the people of Jerusalem were remembering with longing? John Gill says, civil and religious liberties, the word, worship, and ordinances of God, the temple, altars, and courts of the Lord, the ark of his testimony, the symbol of the divine presence, which is the ark, and the revelation of the will of God by the prophets, their peace, prosperity, and enjoyment of all good things. In other words, all the things of Old Testament religion, which we've been looking at for the last several months in this podcast, they're gone. And the people of Jerusalem remember that. They blew it. They threw it all away with their sins. The adversary saw her in verse 7, and they mocked at her ruin. Now, some translations say that the adversaries, the Babylonians, were mocking at the Israelites' Sabbaths. The literal word there is cessation. They mocked at her cessation. That could either mean the cessation of the city or the cessation of the Sabbaths. Most of the translations just have ruin, just like the NASB does, ruin or an equivalent. The adversaries mocked at the smoking ruins of Jerusalem. The Darby note has or cessation or days of rest. They mocked at her Sabbaths. Marginal note, King James actually has Sabbaths. They mocked at her Sabbaths. I don't think so. I think the majority opinion on that is that the adversaries, the Babylonians, were mocking at the ruin of Jerusalem. Verse 8, Jerusalem sinned greatly, therefore she has become an unclean thing. Notice the sin of Jerusalem is constantly being mentioned. This is why this catastrophe has happened. It wasn't a random event. She has become an unclean thing, and that, of course, could mean Jerusalem personified as a woman is unclean. She's misdirecting. In just a minute, I'm going to give you another verse in verse 9, which tends to make one think that that's exactly what the image that Jeremiah was trying to convey here. All who honored her despise her, in verse 8, because they have seen her nakedness. Now, what's the allusion there? It could be an allusion to her harlotry, because harlots would expose themselves to their johns. Or it could be modest women taken captive in the siege of Jerusalem, and their nakedness was then uncovered by brutish and inhuman soldiers. I'm not sure which way Jeremiah was going on that, but either way, it's pretty bad. She groans and turns away. Now in verse 9 and in verse 10, we read this. In Lamentations 1, her uncleanness was in her skirts. Let's just stop right there. Her uncleanness was in her skirts. This pictures a menstruating woman whose blood was flowing down into the skirts of her garments. Pretty sad. And of course, that would make her unclean because of the law that said the menstruating women were unclean. Her uncleanness was in her skirts. She did not consider her future. Therefore, she has fallen astonishingly. She has no comforter. See, O Lord, my affliction, for the enemy has magnified himself. The adversary has stretched out his hand over all her precious things. For she has seen the nations enter her sanctuary, the ones whom you commanded that they should not enter into your congregation. In verse 10, the Babylonians have stretched out their hands over all of Jerusalem's precious things. Some precious things might refer to the goods in the houses of the people of Jerusalem. It might refer to the furniture in the temple, the ark, the table, the altar, the priest's garments, the vessels of the sanctuary, and the gifts which were given to the temple. John Gill says that that's what precious things refers to. Jerusalem has seen the nations enter her sanctuary. Actually, it was the Babylonians. But remember, the Babylonians had a lot of subsidiaries in their army that were provided by the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Syrians, all the nations that Babylon had conquered at one time or another. He could refer to the Moabites and the Ammonites and the Babylonian army in particular. Deuteronomy 23:3 says, no Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of their descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord. The Ammonites and Moabites were not good people. They hated Israel. They hated God's people. They hated Yahweh. And so they were prohibited from the temple. And yet, the nations enter the sanctuary when the temple was burnt down in 586 B.C. I don't think it particularly refers to the Moabites and Ammonites. I just think it's talking about Babylon as a representative of all the Gentile nations. They entered the sanctuary when they burnt it down. We go now to Lamentations 1, verses 11 through 12. All her people groan seeking bread. They have given their precious things for food to restore their lives themselves. See, O Lord, and look, for I am despised. Is it nothing to all you who pass this way? Look and see if there is any pain like my pain, which was severely dealt out to me, which the Lord inflicted on the day of his fierce anger. Now we have a rhetorical shift here in verse 11. We go to the first person singular, for I am despised. Jerusalem is rhetorically speaking now, not Jeremiah. In verse 11, the people of Jerusalem have given their precious things for food. I am sure that included cannibalism, giving their kids. Sometimes I get the 80-70 destruction mixed up with the 586, but I know that there was cannibalism in the siege of 80-70, and I'm pretty sure there was in 586, although I can't recall specifically, because that's what always happens in these sieges. The siege lasted for 30 months, not a lot of food. People get desperate. So Jerusalem, speaking for herself now, says in verse 12, is it nothing to all you who pass the way? Is there any pain like my pain? Rhetorical question. No, nobody suffered like we've suffered. This is an exaggeration, but it's pretty bad. They suffered a very, very bad destruction. And notice who did it, which the Lord inflicted on the day of his fierce anger. Last part of verse 12, the Lord did it. Jerusalem acknowledges that it wasn't just the hand of man that did this. It was not just the Babylonians that did this. Jerusalem acknowledges that they were suffering for their sins, or she was suffering for her sins. We go now to Lamentations 1, verses 13 through 14. From on high he sent fire into my bones. My is referring to Jerusalem still. From on high he, that's God, sent fire into my bones, and it prevailed over them. He has spread a net for my feet. He has turned me back. He has made me desolate, faint all day long. The yoke of my transgressions is bound. By his hand they are knit together. They have come upon my neck. He has made my strength fail. The Lord has given me into the hands of those against whom I am not able to stand. Well, the fire that God sent into the bones of Jerusalem could be the fire that actually burnt Jerusalem, or it could be a metaphorical fire referring to the fire of God's judgment. I tend to think it was literal because that's what happened. The fire prevailed over the bones at the end of verse 13. That's a good picture. Fire usually will eat up one's bones, the bones of a body. The fire ate up Jerusalem. God spread a net, a hunter's net, to capture Jerusalem like a hunted animal. He turned me back like a defeated soldier. He's made me desolate like a wilderness, faint. The NASB margin has sick. Sick all day long. Depends on how you translate that word, faint. The yoke of my transgressions is bound. A yoke is something you put over two oxes' necks to constrain them, to put them in prison, as it were. And so this is a yoke made out of transgressions. Those transgressions, those sins of Jerusalem, formed a yoke which kept the people of Judah in bondage. Sin will do that. It'll put you in bondage. As Adam Clark put it, referring to Jerusalem, I am now tied and bound by the chain of my sins. Verse 14, by his hand they are knit together. What are knit together? The transgressions. As Jameson Fawcett Brown puts it, my sins are like the withes. A withe is a tough, flexible branch used for tying or binding. This is old-fashioned English. My sins are like the withes entwined about the neck to fasten the yoke to. Well, that's really getting into it. Just to say the sins are the yokes and they're binding up the people of Jerusalem. They are knit together. They're tied together. Just like a yoke is tied together with a willowy branch. These sins are tied together around Jerusalem, making Jerusalem a prisoner of sin. The yoke of my transgressions have come about my neck. In verse 14, God has made my strength fail. The Lord has given me into the hands of those against whom I'm not able to stand. That's the Babylonians. We go now to Lamentations 1, verses 15 and 16. The Lord has rejected all my strong men in my midst. He has called an appointed time against me to crush my young men. The Lord has trodden as in a winepress the virgin daughter of Judah. For these things I weep, my eyes run down with water, because far from me is a comforter, one who restores my soul. My children are desolate, because the enemy has prevailed. In verse 15, the strong men are gone. God's rejected them. Because God has called an appointed time against Jerusalem. Now that appointed time is sometimes translated assembly. God has called an assembly against me. That assembly, of course, would be the Babylonian army. Or it's the time that the Babylonian armies are coming. Just depends on the translation. God has called an appointed time against me to crush my young men. Those would be the soldiers to defend Jerusalem. They're crushed. The Lord has trodden as in a winepress, Judah. Remember, winepress is just some stone walls around an area where the grapes were put in. The people would then start stomping on the wine with their feet. So blood was squeezed out of the Jews like the juice was squeezed out of the grapes. So God is stomping on the virgin daughter of Judah. She's called a virgin because before the Babylonians came, she had never been conquered before. Well, she had never been destroyed, let's put it that way. Now she's destroyed. She's been raped. She's not a virgin daughter anymore. Jerusalem says in verse 16, far from me is a comforter. And of course, the comforter is one, capital O in the NASB, the one who restores my soul. That would be God. So God is far from them. Well, that's because they sinned. My children are desolate because the enemy has prevailed. The children, of course, are the population of Jerusalem. The my is referring to Jerusalem still. Jerusalem is still speaking in the first person. Now we go back to Jeremiah speaking in the third person. Zion stretches out her hands. This is in verses 17 and 18. Zion stretches out her hands. There is no one to comfort her. The Lord has commanded concerning Jacob that the ones round about him should be his adversaries. Jerusalem has become an unclean thing among them. The Lord is righteous, for I have rebelled against his command. Now in verse 18, we return to Jerusalem speaking. The Lord is righteous, for I, Jerusalem, have rebelled against his command. Hear now, all peoples, and behold my pain. My virgins and my young men have gone into captivity. Virgins are young women, young men are young men. That's the flower of the nation, the future. Our young people are our future, as I've heard old people say many times. So Zion, that stands for Jerusalem, stretches out her hands. That could either be submitting to their conquerors. I'm not sure how I would picture that. Kind of like in modern times, a prisoner stretches out his hands with his palms upward, saying, put the handcuffs on me. I think, though, from the context, it's referring to reaching out to friends to help. Because the next phrase in verse 17 says, there is no one to comfort her. She stretches out her hands, but there's nobody there to comfort her. Nobody to help her. She's reaching out for help. The Lord has commanded concerning Jacob that the ones round about him should be his adversaries. Now, of course, the enemies around Jerusalem, starting at 12 o'clock high and moving around the clock clockwise, Syria, Ammon, Moab, Arabia, Edom, Egypt, the Philistines, Tyre, and Sidon. They were all conquered by Nebuchadnezzar, thus becoming Judah's enemies. So, in verse 17, the ones round about Jerusalem are now Jerusalem's adversaries, because they're in the Babylonian orbit now. Jerusalem has become an unclean thing among them. The KJV actually translates that as a menstruous woman. That, again, is an interpretation. Most of the other translations say unclean thing or an equivalent, because there's lots of unclean things. But let's face it, a menstruous woman, Jerusalem is portrayed as a woman all the way through this chapter. She's a harlot. She's sitting on the ground mourning. She's got her menstrual blood on her clothes. So it just sounds better to make this a menstruating woman, an unclean thing. And the KJV just does that, translates it that way. Here's what John Gill says about this. Jerusalem was reckoned filthy and unclean, abominable and nauseous, whom none cared to come near, but shunned, despised, and abhorred, as the Jews separated from the Gentiles and would not converse with them. So neither now would the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, with the Jews, but treat them as the offscouring of all things. Now, despite moaning and groaning that she had been destroyed, Jerusalem still admits her sin. She says in verse 18, the Lord is righteous, for I have rebelled against his command, I being Jerusalem. God is righteous, we are not. Smart, very smart. Hear now, all peoples, and behold my pain, my virgins and my young men. Those are the future of Jerusalem, and they're gone into captivity. We go now to Lamentations 1, verses 19 and 20. Jerusalem is still speaking. I called to my lovers, but they deceived me. My priest and my elders perished in the city while they sought food to restore their strength themselves. See, O Lord, for I am in distress. My spirit is greatly troubled. My heart is overturned within me, for I have been very rebellious. In the street the sword slays. In the house it is like death. Her lovers are mentioned again, Jerusalem's lovers. Those are the surrounding nations. In particular, Egypt was a lover of Jerusalem because Pharaoh Hofra actually had an alliance with King Zedekiah. Zedekiah had finked out on the Babylonians, broken his oath to serve the Babylonians, and went down to Egypt to try to get some help. And during that 30-month siege, starting in 588, Hofra actually mustered up some troops and came up to Jerusalem to try to help Jerusalem. The Babylonians withdrew from their siege of Jerusalem just long enough to go down and whip up on the Egyptians. So Egypt deceived her. I'll love you forever, Jerusalem, but at the first sign of trouble, I'll hightail it back to Egypt. So the priests, the elders, the priests of the religious leaders, the elders of the civil leaders, they all perished, not from the sword, but from the famine, while they sought food to restore their strength. And of course, all sieges are accompanied with famine because food is not allowed to come in from the outlying rural precincts where food is grown. And in verse 20, Jerusalem says, oh, my spirit is troubled, my heart is overturned. I've been very rebellious, she admits it again. In the street, the sword slays. People are dying everywhere as the Babylonians come through the wall and whack people. In the house, it is like death. People are sitting in their homes knowing that some of their loved ones have been destroyed by the Babylonians. We go now to Lamentations chapter 1, verses 21 and 22, and we will finish this chapter. They, that's Jerusalem's enemies, they have heard that I groan. There is no one to comfort me. All my enemies have heard of my calamity. They are glad that you have done it. That's referring to all the enemies besides Babylon. Of course, Babylon heard of it. They did it. But all the other enemies around, the Tyrians, the Edomites, the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Syrians, etc., 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 they all heard it because this was big news in the ancient Near East at the time. They have heard of what happened to Jerusalem, and they are glad that you have done it. Schadenfreude. Now notice who the Jews credit for the disaster. They are glad that you, capital Y, Yahweh, you have done it. So Jerusalem is very quick to say in this first chapter of Lamentations that they deserved it. They were guilty, and you did what you had to do. You judged us. But that still doesn't mean that Jerusalem is happy about it, and they don't believe, Jerusalem doesn't believe, that Babylon does not deserve punishment. We continue reading in verse 21, oh, that you, Yahweh, would bring the day which you have proclaimed, that they, my enemies, may become like me, like Jerusalem. In other words, destroyed. So they're praying a little imprecatory prayer here. That day actually did come when Cyrus the Great of Persia captured the city of Babylon in 539, and that's the end of the Babylonian Empire. So they became defeated just like Jerusalem became defeated. The prayer was by Jerusalem that they, the Babylonians, may become like me, Jerusalem. Now, Babylon was not totally destroyed by Cyrus. He treated Babylon very nicely and incorporated Babylon into the Persian Empire. However, Darius I, the Great, around 520, he came in and he leveled Babylon. So at that time, Babylon did become like me, like Jerusalem. Now, Israel had no compunction about wishing for justice on their enemies. As I said earlier, Jerusalem in this poem is wishing for justice for everybody. Not only for them, they admit that God was just to judge them, but they also realize there's a lot of sin, a lot of evil over there in the Babylonian camp, and that needs to get judged too. So when in verse 22, Jerusalem says, let all their wickedness come before you, all the Babylonians' wickedness, this is not a cry for vengeance. This is a cry for justice, rather. Israel knew the Babylonians were just as guilty as she was. Now I'm going to give you a quote from the Armenian Dr. Clark. Quote, imprecations in the sacred writings are generally to be understood as declarative of the evils they indicate, or that such evils will take place. In other words, declarative or predictive, but not, I want it to happen. Clark continues, no prophet of God ever wished a desolation on those against whom he was directed to prophesy. Really? Clark speaks like a true Arminian. Arminians just cannot find it within their loving souls to think that a God of justice might wipe out somebody for their evil. In my opinion, Arminians never have really understood, I'm speaking generally, not all Arminians, of course, but in general, Arminians tend not to see the depths of human depravity that's out there. God wouldn't do that. He wouldn't allow the people of Jerusalem to wish that Babylon be judged. Why not? David did it all the time. Imprecatory psalms are everywhere. So Clark would translate verse 22 this way, all their wickedness will come before you. No, 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 we're not going to go that way. Now here's what Jameson Fawcett Brown says about this imprecatory prayer, and we will finish the chapter up with this quote. Such prayers against foes are lawful if the foe be an enemy of God, and if our concern be not for our own personal feeling, but for the glory of God and the welfare of his people, well, then such prayers are lawful. There's nothing wrong with praying for judgment to come upon the woke fools who are shaking their fist at God and exposing their homosexual genitals to little kids and pushing for little kids to have their gender transferred from one gender to the other, and let's don't let the parents find out about it. No, God's going to judge those people. And there's nothing wrong with praying that the judgment will come quickly, because it needs to. Ladies and gentlemen, with those somewhat depressed words, well, this is a book about lamentations, we have now finished chapter 1. We are now prepared to go to chapter 2. Chapter 2 in Lamentations I will call The Lord Has Destroyed Without Pity. It's very interesting that 4 of the 5 chapters of Lamentations are 22 verses long. That's because 3 of those chapters are acrostic poems, and there are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. The other chapter of Lamentations that's not 22 verses long, chapter 3, it's 66 verses long, and that's because there's one Hebrew letter for every 3 verses of that chapter. Now, chapter 5 is 22 verses long, but it is not an acrostic, so that's just a coincidence. On that side note, I'll say farewell for this chapter. I hope to have you with me in our discussion of Lamentations 2 in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.